Since its founding in 1971 by 13 young Frenchmen, Médecins Sans Frontières has seen its humanitarian movement grow internationally. It now has offices in 28 countries and employs 30,000 people worldwide. 30,000. In AIDS-ravaged South Africa, in war-torn South Sudan and Iraq, the Central African Republic, Doctors Without Borders is there on the front lines, working in some of the most desperate places on Earth. It's estimated that the group has treated more than 100 million patients globally. In 1999, Doctors Without Borders won the Nobel Peace Prize for its work. But despite its prestige and status as one of the most admired organizations in the world, Doctors Without Borders has gone through serious ups and downs, sometimes owing to the culture and ethos of the movement itself. Inherent in everything that the organization does is a commitment to consensual decision-making, an ingrained culture of debate, and a deep sense of self-criticism. My guest this hour is Renee Fox, a sociologist with considerable scholarship in medicine. Her studies in the sociology of medicine, medical ethics, research, and education have taken her all over the world and have resulted in several books. The most recent, the one in my hands, Doctors Without Borders, Humanitarian Quests, Impossible Dreams of Médecins Sans Frontières. With unprecedented access, Renee Fox spent nearly 20 years doing research and in-depth interviews with the organization's members and doctors. And her ability to have both an insider's and an outsider's perspective on the group has afforded a unique take on this. It's a fascinating history. Renee Fox is the Annenberg Professor Emerita of the Social Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, her book is Doctors Without Borders, Humanitarian Quest, Impossible Dreams of MSF, or Médecins Sans Frontières. So, Renee Fox, it's a pleasure to get to speak with you about this organization, and I congratulate you on the publication of this book. And thank you for being with us on Midday today.
Thank you for inviting me to be a member of your program.
Great. I think we should just go right to the beginning, Renee Fox. 13 young Frenchmen. It's December 1971, just before Christmas. Let's talk about the founding of Doctors Without Borders.
Well, it was a small group of French physicians and also several medical journalists who were involved in doing medical humanitarian work in Nigeria during the civil war in that country and in the area, the Biafran area of the country. And the young French physicians were working under the aegis of the International Red Cross. They, at that time, under the regulations of the International Red Cross, they were obliged to sign a contract which indicated that they would not speak publicly about what they saw in the field in delivering the humanitarian care that they had come to carry out. These young physicians felt there was something amiss about that commitment, the commitment not to speak about what they saw in the field that they thought might be a violation of human rights and that a larger world ought to know about. And they felt that the members of the area, the Biafran area of Nigeria, were being subjected to behavior that violated human rights. And they felt that it was important to speak out about it. And so they challenged the commitment to professional secrecy, so to speak, the confidentiality that physicians normally maintain vis-a-vis the patients for whom they care, and brought forth a principle of humanitarian action, which they called witnessing or témoignage in French, challenging the long-standing moral commitment to remain silent out of respect for the persons for whom they were caring.
For those who don't fully remember the history in Biafra, I mean, there were accusations of genocide, of manufactured famine of the native people there.
Yes, that is correct. That became one of the basic principles of their so-called charter, which is a document usually referred to in print with a capital C, their basic principles of neutrality, impartiality, and témoignage are the principles under which they have continued to operate throughout their more than 40-year-long history.
You know, I love this word, témoignage. Actually, I learned this word from your book. Means acting and speaking or witnessing, right?
Witnessing, that's correct.
Yeah. So those are the two pillars then of the Médecins Sans Frontières would be acting and speaking and treating people.
Well, also the principle of neutrality and impartiality,
right,
to act independently with regard to political, military, or religious agendas. Those are the pillars of their moral commitments.
It's interesting. You said there were some medical journalists included in this group, but it wasn't all doctors.
They were editors of a publication that no longer exists called Tonus, T-O-N-U-S.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all medically trained persons.
So how did they get started, Renee Fox? How did Médecins Sans Frontières, how did they go into action?
They basically started as a French organization with a so-called without borders perspective. In other words, a perspective that was global, allegedly global and international and even transnational. Their very name, Doctors Without Borders, connotes that. On the other hand, they originally were a very French organization, very French not only in the fact that the original branch of MSF was located in France, in Paris, but also French in its cultural outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And the second group to form a chapter of MSF was a Belgian group of physicians, inspired by what their French colleagues had created, who wanted then to have an MSF Belgium as part of the larger organization. Interestingly enough, in the early stages of the development of Doctors Without Borders, although the vision was transnational and without frontiers, the French branch of MSF, the only one that existed at that time, was not totally hospitable to the creation of a second branch of MSF. So there were some very kind of turbulent years in which, as gradually other groups of physicians and health professionals in other countries were inspired to create chapters of MSF under their aegis. First it was Belgium, then it was Switzerland and Holland and Spain, for example. There was a certain amount of internal tension in the organization because with each new office, so to speak, of MSF, the question of how to be multicultural as well as global, internally as well as externally at the same time arose. That is, how to recognize the cultural differences between the different groups who cumulatively were becoming members of MSF and at the same time unite them in a perspective that transcended their cultural differences.
Right, right. Such a challenge that would be to maintain your mission, to maintain the original mission of the organization as it spreads into different countries and different cultures.
Quite analogous to the challenge of the European Union, when you think of it.
Right.
I mean, which is struggling mightily at the present time,
right,
to recognize the national historical and cultural distinctiveness of each of the countries that belongs to it, and at the same time to unify in a way that transcends those differences.
Renee Fox, this is really interesting to me, the idea of independence, or neutrality, I should say, because when you go back to the original story, the founding of Médecins Sans Frontières, it seems like the key there was that in working for the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, contracts were signed. There might have been some money involved, and MSF didn't want that. They didn't want to have any kind of to be co-opted in any way.
They have. You probably know this, but more than 85% of their funds come from private sources, all of them non-governmental.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. I think it's amazing.
100%.
I think it's amazing. They've turned down money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yes, they collaborate with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the sense of conferring with each other about the action in which they're engaged, but they receive no money from that foundation. And their great aspiration is to be so independent that 100% of their monies would come from non-governmental sources or any source that could in any way challenge their total commitment to neutrality and impartiality and independence.
I receive solicitations from Médecins Sans Frontières in the mail, as do probably a lot of people listening to our show right now. So that's how they get most of their money.
Most of their money comes from the way you and I respond to those solicitations.
Yeah.
And they work very hard to achieve that.
So people admire this group. What do you think? I don't know if you have an impression of Americans' impressions of this group. What do you think the average American thinks of Médecins Sans Frontières? That it's doing some good, but do you think Americans understand the ethos and the culture of the movement?
That's a very good question. I think the American public is very enthusiastic about Doctors Without Borders in general. And usually when I've mentioned that I've been working, trying to come to understand them better from the inside as well as from the outside, people tell me this is one of my favorite charities. This is one of the organizations to which I give funds with the greatest enthusiasm. But I'm not sure that they have access to understanding the very distinctive culture that Doctors Without Borders have, a culture to being committed to remaining a movement and not just succumbing to becoming an ordinary organization, a very strong commitment to participatory democracy, a culture of debate in which they're constantly examining themselves and criticizing themselves, speaking of them, of what they have to offer as an imperfect offering, a strong allegiance to the notion that ideas matter for action, non-heroic heroism, a special genre of humor about themselves, and that is epitomized perhaps in what you may have noticed is the frontispiece of my book, which is a cartoon that was drawn by a member of MSF France at an international meeting of MSF. I don't know whether you want me to
Why don't you describe it? It involves windmills.
Yes. Well, yeah. It's actually relevant to the subtitle of my book. It is a cartoon of Don Quixote and his companion.
Sancho Panza.
Riding on little miniature Land Rovers like the ones that MSF uses,
right,
holding in their hands large instruments which, if you look closely, look like hypodermic needles rather than lances,
right,
riding toward windmills whose spokes are made up of strange human arms and legs. And in the distance, you can see a starry sky. Now, this cartoon was printed on the front of the T-shirts that everybody in MSF wore to this international meeting. And on the back of their T-shirts were the lyrics of the song The Impossible Dream from the musical play The Man from La Mancha. It epitomizes the perspective that MSF has on its missions, the capacity that they have to be humorous about themselves, the insistence they have on not being too solemn, and the constant process through which they have examined and questioned themselves over the course of the 40-some-odd years that they have been in existence. At that meeting, incidentally, to which the members of MSF wore these T-shirts, that cartoonist put up on the screen a cartoon every time somebody said something that seemed to be momentous. And each time it was a satiric commentary on what they had said.
I like this.
I was tempted to put into the book a footnote, which I resisted doing, suggesting that faculty meetings would profit greatly if they had cartoonists who was present putting up on a screen cartoon versions of what the members of the faculty were saying at those meetings.
Renee Fox is our guest in this hour of midday, sociologist and medicine scholar. She's talking about a cartoon, just driving for us, a cartoon in the front of her book, Doctors Without Borders, Humanitarian Quests, Impossible Dreams of Médecins Sans Frontières. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. More on this one when we get back. A short break here on midday, and we'll return and continue our conversation with Renee Fox. And welcome back to the Midday Show on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with sociologist and medicine scholar Renee Fox about her new book, Doctors Without Borders, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. A couple of quick questions for you, Renee Fox. What kind of doctors are drawn to Médecins Sans Frontières? How long do they work for the organization? How well are they paid? Some basic information like that. I think I'm curious about who actually, you know, goes to work for Doctors Without Borders.
They are not all physicians. They are physicians and nurses and other kinds of medical, paramedical personnel.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting question about what kinds of persons are drawn to this, what they insist is a movement and not just an organization. There are many such persons who do this for a certain interlude in their lives when they are relatively free to do so, and do a numerous missions and then recede into a life which doesn't involve them in such direct contact with all the human suffering in the world to which such a movement responds. However, what I've been struck by, although there are numerous members of MSF who have made this a lifetime commitment, which is quite extraordinary since they are not handsomely paid, they're not volunteer in the sense that they receive no remuneration, but you can't become prosperous by becoming a member, a permanent member of MSF. The ones I know who have done some stints in MSF and who have then gone on, usually in medically relevant or philanthropically relevant lives, are very drawn to work that continues to involve them, even if it's not directly in the field, to issues, involves them in issues that have some relevance to what it is that drew them to MSF to begin with. Those who leave MSF who have been with it for a period of time of some duration find it quite difficult to find in the outside world, so to speak, something that is as compelling, as meaningful as what the years that they spent with MSF meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I could exactly give you a characterological sketch of the kinds of people who become members of MSF, but they are like many of the people I have taught, as a matter of fact, in some ways, young men and young women with a great interest in making a positive difference in the world, of responding to the issues and the problems and the suffering that is not only out there in the faraway spaces, but even fairly close to home,
right.
Many of whom have medical or public health relevant interests, and who yearn for a way to put these kinds of feelings and these kinds of motives into some kind of meaningful action. You may remember that the first chapter of the book, which is called Blogs from the Field, comes from the kinds of logs that many of MSF members kept while they were in the field, in which they, with remarkable eloquence, I think.
I want to read one. Can I read one?
Oh, that would be wonderful.
There's tremendous insight from these blog posts that you quote in your book, Doctors Without Borders. And I wanted to take a moment just to read one here, because just to follow up on my own question about what kind of person is drawn to work for MSF. So if you don't mind, Renee Fox, I want to read one of these posts. And this is from Workers in the Field, blogs from Workers in the Field of Médecins Sans Frontières. Here's one I wanted to read. If we allow ourselves to see our humanitarian experience as occurring between two worlds, of seeing crisis situations as involving a difference of essence and not merely of degree vis-a-vis our culture of origin, we fall prey to the romantic characteristic of colonialism. Each of us is drawn to the challenge of improving the human condition, but the adventure of MSF field experience should not be interpreted as an initiation into some higher, more profound form of understanding the human condition. To romanticize it in this way is to mystify the humanitarian experience, to pretend that some fundamental transformation takes place in our way of seeing the world, is in effect to exploit the plight of the people we aim to assist as an opportunity for our own personal development. The fantasy of MSS field experience as a rite of passage onto some higher plane of human understanding is replete with narcissism. even more repulsive because this so-called initiation is parasitic on the host of the suffering we seek to eradicate. In short, there is absolutely nothing otherworldly about humanitarian experience in the field. To assume so is to posit an artificial difference in kind between us and them.
That's exactly the passage that I had marked in the book that I have here with me to read if I had a chance to do so.
I'm sorry. I enjoyed reading
It's so beautiful. It's extraordinary because without any kind of prior arrangement with you, you picked the passage I wanted to read.
Okay, great. Well, I mean, we learned so much from that about the attitude, the mentality, why we're doing this.
Yes, and the notion of not heroizing one's heroism is very strong within MSF. But I ended the book by saying that as I left the last meeting that I observed in the course of these many years of being a participant observer among them, I looked at the list of persons that were posted at that meeting who over the course of MSF's history had lost their lives in service. And I thought, and I wrote that I knew they would not want me to dramatize that. And then I also said, as I exited from the field finally, that I also knew that they would not want me to dramatize how much it had meant to me to be a participant observer among them and to be leaving finally at this moment. And that's the way the book ends. And I think I've been true to their ethos in that way. Also, as you may remember, when they won the Nobel Prize, of course they were joyous, but that immediately created a crisis of good fortune internally to MSF because they were worried about being, as they put it, nobelized rather than being rebellious in the Albert Camus sense of the term.
Right.
They were worried that they would become routinized, that they would become so much appreciated by the larger world and so forth, that they would lose the effervescence of a movement. So that fundamentally, they spend as much time worrying about the negative side effects of winning the Nobel Prize as in celebrating the fact that they had been awarded it.
How did they settle that?
They settled it. First of all, also, there was the problem of participatory democracy. Everybody had equal right to say what kind of speech should be given, what the content should be, and who should write it. And that turned out to be rather dysfunctional.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, then, I can imagine.
Then there was the question of there was a moment in time when MSF France felt that special attention should be given to them in the acceptance speech because they had founded MSF. That was immediately disputed because that was considered to be a violation of the vision of Without Borders. And then there was a great deal of discussion, deliberation, argumentation about what the content of the Nobel Peace Prize speech should be and who should give it. And it took a very long time to resolve it. In fact, it was at the very last second, practically, but the night before the speech had to be delivered and the Nobel Prize was awarded, that all of this was resolved and the last words were put on the speech. I can't think of any other group. I can't imagine any other group that would go into crisis because it won a Nobel Prize.
Right. Well, there's a lot of, as you say in the book, there's a lot of self-criticism. There's a lot of internal debate. There was a debate about whether to go to South Africa and to step into the battle against AIDS. What was that debate about?
Well, it's one of the many kinds of moral dilemmas intrinsic to medical humanitarian action that MSF faces. And one of them, for example, is how to allocate commitments and personnel and material resources in relationship to all the natural and human-made disasters and suffering that exist in the world. Earlier work of MSF was largely focused on emergency missions. Something you mentioned, Ebola, that would be considered to be an emergency mission. But the great decision that they had to make in this area concerned whether or not they were going to undertake, for example, the care of HIV/AIDS. A pandemic which involved caring for people for all the rest of their lives if, in fact, intervening in their condition could help to sustain their lives. That would mean an enormous amount of resources in personnel, in materiel, in medicaments and so forth would have to go into HIV/AIDS, which meant that they would then not perhaps be able to allocate some of their resources to other things in the world that were very pressing indeed. So the long debate about HIV/AIDS really involved a shift to some extent in what it was that MSF was going to commit to. In this case, a pandemic disease which involved continuing care for the people who they undertook to respond to.
I need to ask you this question at this juncture then, after we've discussed the Nobel Prize debate, and now you've just described the AIDS-HIV dilemma that MSF faced in South Africa. So my question is this, doesn't all of this get in the way? In concept, it sounds wonderful to have self-criticism, internal debates about everything. But when you're running an organization like this, a humanitarian medical organization trying to respond to emergencies around the world, whether brought on by disease or famine, weather conditions or war, doesn't some of this just get in the way and slow things down?
Yes, I've wondered about this for 20 years or so. But you would imagine that they would be totally paralyzed as they debated endlessly these very complex issues. With regard to the Ebola outbreak, which you spoke of, they were ready to respond instantly, sending in tons of equipment and with personnel added to the personnel they already had in those areas. I'm not sure I have ever solved the problem of being able to delineate the way a sociologist ought to be able to do exactly how they make their decisions. I think there is something, in spite of the many sections of MSF and its decentralized notion and the fact that it, even though it has an international president, that international president is not a CEO in the usual sense. There is inside of MSF a kind of informal hierarchy in which certain people do have more influence in the decision-making than others. They're not easy to identify, and it may change from one set of issues to another. But they do not get paralyzed in endless debate which impedes their ability to go into the field. They are able to do that from the point of view of personnel and equipment instantaneously, actually.
That is amazing. You know, there's a lot of folks in Baltimore, in Maryland, involved in running, working for nonprofit organizations, many of them, some international in scope. Catholic Relief Services, for instance, is headquartered here, along with some other humanitarian organizations that are headquartered in Baltimore. You know, they might listen to your description of this and wonder how their organization, which they call an organization, not a movement, would function. Is there another example such as this anywhere else that you know of?
I frankly don't know of any other.
Yeah.
And I would be extremely interested if some of your listeners could provide me with an example of an organization which has not only insisted on continuing to be a movement, but has succeeded in being a movement for 40-some-odd years, that has all these attributes of a movement that I've described, and that is still able to maintain their integrity in that sense and yet respond with alacrity and efficacy to the missions that they have undertaken over the years. If they floundered in the field, the world would know about it. Mm-hmm. They are so visible, they are so admired, that if they really didn't do a good job, they wouldn't be able to hide that.
And can you talk about this a little bit, Renee Fox? How do governments respond to the presence of Médecins Sans Frontières when they're there? And say, for instance, in the middle of a civil war or a tribal war or something like we see in the Central African Republic right now, how do local governments or the national governments of these countries respond to their presence?
With respect, but on the other hand, MSF is extremely intent on making sure that they are not confused with whatever humanitarian aid governments, which also have a military presence, have brought into the area. And that is a source of danger for their workers, incidentally, apart from their principles, for them to be confused with, let's say, what the U.S. military is bringing in the way of humanitarian aid, as well as war weaponry and so forth, is to make them vulnerable to being seen as allied with military action, political action. This is one of the intrinsic dilemmas that MSF constantly has to face. And incidentally, this kind of humanitarian action has become more and more dangerous physically as time has unfolded, given the nature of the conflicts in the middle of which they find themselves. And rather ironically and paradoxically in some ways, their principle of witnessing can also be a source of danger and a source of harm even, because by speaking out about what they see, which ought not ideally to be happening, they put themselves at risk. They put the members, incidentally, the personnel of MSF is made up largely of persons who are indigenous to the countries in which they work, so that as much as 90% of their personnel is indigenous to the countries where you will find them in the field.
I wanted to ask you about that, because that's important to this discussion about danger and how they get along with governments. Indigenous people who are employed by Doctors Without Borders, well, they have a problem if there's too much witnessing, if there's too much speaking out about conditions or criticism of the government, because they're on the ground, they live there. They haven't parachuted in like some other doctors or staff might have.
That is correct. And MSF is not happy to take the option of leaving the field if it becomes too dangerous. But sometimes they have to. And the personnel who come from outside the country in which they're working have a possibility of leaving, physically leaving. The people working with them who are indigenous to the country don't. So they are, as you say, potentially much more vulnerable. And that is an issue. It's also an irony that the nobility of witnessing should be a source of potential harm as well as a source of great good. And incidentally, I guess one of the more definitive things that can happen if they witness is that the whole bunch of them can be expelled from the country, as has recently happened, as you may know, in ex-Burma, where MSF was expelled by the government because they were working with an ethnic minority in the country who were of Bangladesh origins and so forth, who were more or less kind of incarcerated in an almost a prison camp-like way in the country. They were the only people giving care to those persons, and they witnessed about what they saw and the conditions under which those persons were being kept, and they were invited out of the country. They have returned to the country. They're not permitted to work with that group, and I assume that they're negotiating with the government to be able to do it. The problem with all of this also is that MSF is determined to be apolitical, and yet there's the consequences of their action can be deeply political. So how do you negotiate between being apolitical and acting in ways that have deep political consequences? And incidentally, that is also related to the limitations of what MSF and other groups like them can and cannot do. Much of the suffering that they respond to, be it illness or other forms of suffering that is medically relevant, has deep cultural, historical, political, and economic roots. And they really can change the political and the economic and the cultural and social roots, so that the question of whether they can do something to eliminate the conditions that have played a role in causing the suffering that they're responding to is a very moot one indeed.
Renee Fox. I'm sorry, Renee, finish, please.
Yes.
Did you want to finish? A source of great
dilemma and great frustration, obviously.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there. We have to take a little break again. We'll come back and talk some more, okay? Renee C. Fox is the Annenberg Professor of Emerita of the Social Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania, author of several books. Her latest is Doctors Without Borders, Humanitarian Quests, Impossible Dreams of Médecins Sans Frontières. This is Midday. Dan Roderick's here. A short break, and then we'll resume our conversation. And welcome back to Midday with our guest, Renee Fox, who's written a book about Doctors Without Borders. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. You know, when I was asking you before, Renee Fox, about who is drawn to work for Doctors Without Borders. I wondered, those people who go to work for MSF, do they stay very long? Do they do a stint of a couple of years? Are some of them long-timers or totally committed to this, make a career of it?
All of the same.
Yeah, really?
They're all different, yes. And as I said before, those who do a stint and then go on to do other things often do work that has some relationship to the kind of commitment that they made to MSF. And they remain very much in touch with people they knew when they were with MSF. But there are persons, and some of them you meet in my book, like, for example, the physician who really was responsible for mounting the HIV-AIDS project in the Khayelitsha township of Cape Town in South Africa. His is a lifetime commitment. He's been in it since he was a young man, and he's not that old now, but his wife and his children and he all migrated to South Africa, and that's where they live and work.
Were you familiar with Dr. Richard Rockefeller?
I wasn't familiar with him personally, but I know his story. Yeah. Maybe you're...
I just noticed I'm only catching up with this news that he had died in a plane crash in June 2014, June 13th or June 12th, and he was a founding member of Doctors Without Borders USA.
Yes, he was. He actually, he was head of the board of directors of MSF USA in New York for many years, and he made MSF known, really, in the United States. It was, after all, originally a European movement, still struggling to unbecome as European as it is.
Mm-hmm.
What he did, I think, was not only, I'm sure he must have contributed some monies to MSF, but more importantly, he made MSF known in the United States, and he himself went into the field and did missions. He was, as I understand it, a general practitioner in a town in Maine, but he also went into the field to do medical humanitarian work.
Renee Fox, we talked a little bit earlier about HIV/AIDS and post-apartheid South Africa and MSF's efforts there. What about post-Soviet Russia? That's another focus of your book. Could you talk about that?
Yes, there the major missions of MSF have been, on the one hand, working with the thousands of homeless persons on the streets of Moscow, including homeless children, and then working with the epidemic of tuberculosis inside the gulag-like prisons in Siberia. And that includes, incidentally, having to deal with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, which is another genre of tuberculosis that people are currently struggling with. Again, an ironic consequence in some ways of the misuse of the antibiotics we have.
Yes.
I see overuse of them.
I see numerous references to this in the press. Doctors Without Borders and DR-TB, drug-resistant tuberculosis.
Then there's extra drug-resistant tuberculosis in addition. Yes, it's one of the major epidemics in the world and one that we certainly were not anticipating. We thought we had conquered the white plague, if you may remember, earlier in the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
and it's come back to haunt us with vengeance, with the emergence and reemergence of many infectious diseases. So this one is one of the worst, huh?
So they went right to it. They went to this epidemic of TB in the penal colonies of Siberia.
That's correct.
We ought to talk a little bit about the scope of Médecins Sans Frontières, where they are in the world. What kind of work have you seen them done, and what stories are you most moved by?
That's a very difficult question. As a matter of fact, one of my big questions in doing this research to begin with was how could one lonely sociologist encompass all of MSF, particularly since my mode of research is ethnographic and involves participant observation.
Right.
So the cases that are in the book are the ones that I decided to focus on because they have within them the phenomena and the themes that were more general than those particularities. The issue about how do you decide, if you look out at the world this afternoon and try to chronicle in your mind how many phenomena, how many crises, how many forms of suffering exist in the world to which an organization, movement like MSF might respond, it's infinite. And they have to make a decision about whether they're going to go to South Africa and work with HIV/AIDS and then move on from there to deal with HIV/AIDS in many other parts of the world, and why they're going to go there and what they're not going to be able to do if they do that. I don't think there's no formula for that. They don't have a list of, you know, these do's and don'ts of response. They have to reflect on those things each time some situation presents itself to which they might appropriately and efficaciously respond.
And there's no hierarchy of decision-making, it sounds like.
No, there is no hierarchy of decision-making. There's another issue. How long should they stay in an area when they have undertaken a mission? Should they stay forever? How can they tell when they have done all that they can possibly do that and the time has come to leave, and perhaps they've made enough impact so that others will be able within the country will be able to take over and continue with that work? There's no formula for that either, and you will find, I think, if you look at the dates when they began their work in various parts of the world, that they have stayed for years and years and years. I happen to have worked for many years in the Democratic Republic of Congo when it was Zaire. And MSF has been in that country, the former ex-Belgian Congo, since 1981. They're still there, and they're not leaving.
Is the mission the same, or do they just find new work? At some point after a crisis, say a natural disaster, for instance, that you can almost, maybe you can't see it when you first arrive, but there's an end point to that at some point where you're going to hand off to the local doctors. You've done all you can. It's time to move on to the next crisis. But in other situations, such as HIV/AIDS in South Africa, so they've made some advances there, and yet it's still a huge problem. How did MSF, for instance, how did it finally resolve with South Africa? Is it still there?
They haven't left.
They haven't left.
and what's more, they may continue to work in the same area in which to which they originally responded, but as they stay on, there may be other things that occur to which they also respond. And given the predicament, the pervasive problems of a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, what would be the wonderful day that one might expect to occur when they could feel that the time has come to say we've done the best we can do, it has been helpful, and now let's move on to other things and use our energies and personnel and materiel elsewhere. In most of the places in which you find them in the world, they have been there for very long times. Mm. If you could say that success would be that they can leave, and you could, in a way, you can say the fact that they are still present in so many of these places indicates what they call an imperfect offering.
You know what I find? I think what's key here is integrity. It's so important in an organization. Well, they don't call themselves an organization. They call themselves a movement, but we'll use that word organization. Doctors Without Borders. All of those things that you discussed earlier in our hour together here, Renee Fox. You know, the self-criticism, the internal debates, the way decisions are made. But there's integrity. If there's a scandal, it certainly hasn't been over fundraising that I'm aware of, no. Because that would hurt fundraising, right? That would cut off your crowdfunding, so to speak, with this type of organization. So integrity is so important. The humanitarian mission, of course, but doing it with integrity.
And doing it with integrity when it involves as many people as it does, as many countries as it does, the large funds that it does is extraordinary. But they are, without being pious, they would hate to be thought of as sanctimonious, as you've already indicated from that wonderful
that
passage
post,
that you read.
Mm.
They have managed to be collectively true to their founding principles over the course of more than 40 years.
Since 1971.
That's correct.
Those 13 young Frenchmen who founded the group in December 71, are any of them still around?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, at the 40th anniversary meeting of MSF that I went to in a suburb of Paris, naturally, some of the founding members of MSF, who are now elderly men, came to that meeting and gave testimony about the beginnings of the movement and about what kinds of... They were young radical men, actually, many of them. There weren't that many of them in that small group, who came out of the 1960s and the student revolt and the kind of social movements of the 1960s as they occurred in France. Not from working class backgrounds, I think mainly from bourgeois backgrounds and so forth, but with a sense of social mission, a sense of social justice, a sense of social protest. And seeing these men at that 40th anniversary meeting that I went to, they still have that fire in them. They may be, and although MSF is not inclined to exhibit emotional displays, after these men spoke, everybody stood up in that meeting and applauded endlessly. Hmm. Just seeing these men and also seeing how the flame was still alive in them was extraordinary, including the disputes that they'd had, which they were still capable of reanimating. Huh?
Wow. MSF has opened offices in 28 countries. Today, MSF employs more than 30,000 people across the world. Since its founding, it has treated over 100 million patients, with 8.3 million outpatient consultations being carried out in 2012 alone. I quote there from our guest's book. Renee Fox has been our guest in this hour of midday. Her book is Doctors Without Borders, Humanitarian Quests, Impossible Dreams of Médecins Sans Frontières. A much admired organization that everybody knows in the United States is Doctors Without Borders. And obviously, it's been getting some support from the United States, from people mailing checks in or going online to make donations, because, as you say, 90% of its funding has come that way, which is indeed impressive. And you think about, I use the word crowdfunding. That's the way things are done these days. So anyway, Renee Fox, congratulations on the book, and thank you for doing it. It's an organization I've always wanted to learn more about, and I thank you for that.
Thank you for the privilege of appearing on your program.
Renee Fox, our guest in midday in this hour, is the Annenberg Professor Emerita of the Social Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. Her book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you, Renee.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody. That's our first hour of midday for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stick around for the second hour of our show, coming up after the news from NPR. We'll take a break here for lunch, provided today by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Its catering menu includes deli and sandwich platters, fruit and cheese plates, and desserts. Apples and Oranges Fresh Market is open daily at 1900 North Broadway in Baltimore. More information at applesandorangesmarket.com.